a.m. in the Bronx, New York. I'm on the corner of 187th and Belmont Avenue. This was my neighborhood. I can still hear a million voices in my head. Hear a million stories. This is a Bronx tale, and it's my story. The world I lived in, the people I knew. It's just a Bronx tale, and like they all do, it starts right here on Belmont Avenue.
Hello and welcome to Broadway Videos. This week on Broadway for Sunday, April 2nd, 2017. My name is James Marino, and on the broadcast today we have Peter Felicia and Genesessa Fox. Peter is a theater journalist and historian with a number of books. His most recent is The Great Parade, which is available everywhere. His columns appear at MTI, Masterworks, Broadway, Broadway Select, and many other places. Also with us is Genesessa Fox. Jenna is a theater writer and reviewer whose articles have appeared at timeoutnewyork.com, playbill.com, broadwayworld.com, and newyorktheaterguide.com.
As they pass my stoop, and the pushcart peddlers, they hawk their wares door to door. While the jukebox jockeys dance in the candy store.
With us today, we have a very special guest joining us by telephone. Bobby Conti Thornton is with us. Broadway fans will know Bobby from his Broadway debut in A Bronx Tale on Broadway, where he's playing the role of Calogero. So, Bobby, thank you so much for getting up on a Sunday morning and chatting with us on Broadway Radio.
It's no problem. Thanks for having me.
Oh, absolutely. So, Calogero, I'm getting that right, correct?
Calogero, yes.
Calogero. What was your introduction to the role of Calogero?
I saw the movie when I was about 10 years old. I think every Catholic Italian household has seen that movie at some point in their lives. But I hadn't seen it in about a decade until when I got the audition. I started re-looking at the material and getting back into it. But it had been a while, and then I just started delving down the rabbit hole and into this glorious world about Chazz Palminteri's life, and it's been wonderful.
So you are, as I was reading, you're from San Francisco, grew up and born and raised there, and a graduate of the University of Michigan in 2015. So what brought you from California to University of Michigan?
You know, Michigan just very randomly has this a really extraordinary musical theater program.
Yes.
That's one of the best in the country. Mm-hmm. And so I just applied there to and a bunch of other schools, and that's where I ended up deciding to go. And, you know, it's the weather is a lot different. And, you know, we actually I think it was my junior year. The University of Michigan had its first snow day in about 25 years. You know, it's very rare to have too much snow and too much hail to get people to stop, because Ann Arbor is sort of bred and just like snow comes down, the snow trucks come in and plow the streets and we're heading off. But, it was quite a trip, and it was the most glorious city to spend 4 years in and have that time in college for.
So you were looking, as in your youth, you were looking towards the University of Michigan consciously towards musical theater. So being in, you know, on the West Coast, although you're in San Francisco, not Los Angeles, did you have a yearning for film and television?
You know, I think I was always I began as a singer, and then acting came in around age 8 when I first did my first show. And I had never done any TV and film, even though I'm from California. I've actually never been to LA. I was just talking about this with a friend of mine because Disneyland is Anaheim, correct?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And we've never driven down to LA, which is just so odd. And I have no doubt LA will come into my life at some point, but I always had, my grandparents are from Long Island. So I grew up coming to New York as a kid and seeing Broadway shows as a kid. So I think that's I always had that image in my head of what I would hope my life would perhaps be. But as much as I'd love TV and film, I never sort of thought of that as an immediate path more than I did of theater.
Are your parents or siblings or anybody else in your family involved in the arts?
No, my family is composed of a bunch of very intelligent scientists.
Oh.
My mom runs a pharmaceutical company. My uncle is a cancer surgeon. My grandpa had his own pharmacy in the city. My younger sister just is about to graduate from Dartmouth and pre-med. And I'm like, I want to sing and dance. So it was very odd, but they're incredibly, incredibly supportive. But no, I didn't have anyone really in the family to look up to in that way.
That's very exciting to hear, especially that your family is so supportive and that.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. It's all about fostering passion. As long as you're not complacent and you have a drive to do what you love, but as long as that's filled with genuine love for what you do, then you got to go forth.
And you mentioned that you were a singer. You sang in a church choir, or?
My mom just put me in a choir when I was, I think, 3 years old, just because she was so annoyed of me singing around the house all the time. So she put me in a choir because she thought it would shut me up, but it only fostered it more. And it wasn't a church choir. I don't remember what it was. Just either in San Francisco. We lived, when I was younger, we actually lived in Palo Alto, which is sort of near Stanford.
Yeah.
So I was put in a choir there, and then that I got my first voice teacher from there, and then I did my first show when I was 8, which was The Wizard of Oz. I played a flying monkey, and I got the bug right there.
You tell your mother, careful what you say, children will listen. So
that's right. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Speaking of Mr. Sondheim, you did an all-male version of Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum at Two River in New Jersey.
Yeah.
So tell us about that.
It was extraordinary. It was the second job I did out of school, and it was wonderful. I mean, what we found doing it, because it was a production that had done in Williamstown 5 years prior, that Jessica Stone and her husband, Chris Fitzgerald, was playing Pseudolus and she was directing. And it's sort of a really wonderful way to translate the story for a 21st century audience, because it makes the overt sexism in the writing very self-aware, and it puts the joke on the male archetype by having all men play it and not in drag. So that, like, for example, my Philia was not dolled up, you know, there was no chest hair shaven, there was no makeup. We just played it as it would have been at the time that this story would have been written. So we are very much Protean storytellers, just presenting this to the audience. And it was with Chris Fitzgerald and Michael Urie and just these extraordinary comedy actors. And I hope it transfers to Broadway simply just for Chris Fitzgerald, because his Pseudolus was pretty exemplary.
On other mornings, Peter Felicia and Michael Portantier are also here. Both of them, Michael's actually down in Washington, D.C., seeing some shows, and Peter's at a drama desk meeting this morning. But they reported on the Two River Forum, and they were both very excited about it, thought it was an excellent production. So hopefully there is a future in that there. What did you play in Forum?
I was Hero. I got to sing Love I Hear, which is the most gorgeous Sondheim song. So I had a blast. I had an absolute blast.
Switching gears to back up to the east end of Long Island, you did My Fair Lady. Were you Freddie?
I was Freddie. Yep. Got to sing On the Street Where You Live in the Hamptons.
Freddie Einsford Hill. So
absolutely.
You got, you've been playing all these really great things. Also, you had some great roles at the Paper Mill Playhouse. You did Danny Zuko in Grease. That was during University of Michigan or after? I wasn't sure.
Yeah, that was between my junior and senior year of college at Michigan. I was just very fortunate. I had an agent I was freelancing with at the time, and the audition for it just happened to line up with my spring break. And I was already just going to be in New York to see my grandparents. And I got it, and they gave me a huge break. They let a college kid lead their show. And I met some really wonderful people that are still very much friends to this day in that cast. Even though I wasn't at the Paper Mill production in Bronx Tale, it's very full circle that Bronx Tale began at Paper Mill Playhouse. Because that's the theater that gave me my equity card. So I lucked out, man. It was pretty amazing.
Speaking of other shows from Paper Mill that traversed the stages there, Comedy of Tenors, you did at the Cleveland Playhouse at the McCarter Theater Center also.
That was the world premiere. And oh, my God. Best time. Best time.
An original Ken Ludwig play, the sequel to Lend Me a Tenor. So how did you get involved with that?
It was one of my first auditions out of school. And I walked in and they needed someone to do farce comedy, but also to sing, you know, very legit and or operatic. And that's where my voice sort of naturally sits. And so I went in and kind of just I was like, you need me to be Italian and sort of self-effacing and funny and sing opera, bring it on. Like, sounds like a blast. So, you know, it was the best time. And my entrance was, because I don't know if you've seen it at that Paper Mill Playhouse. Mm. My character is under the covers spooning on a couch with his girlfriend in the show. And he's wearing 1930s high-waisted tidy whities. And we're there for 20 minutes and then we pop up. And it's the greatest entrance I will ever have in my entire life. Just like instantaneous laughter.
Oh, boy. And then you also worked with Richard Maltby Jr. doing the off-Broadway production of Starting Here, Starting Now. And I mean, these are just the things we've talked about in the last 5 minutes are all, you know, in and around New York. Of course, you've got the Broadway thing going right now. This has been a whirlwind couple of years since your graduation 2 years ago from Michigan.
Yeah, you know, it'll be 2 years in about a month, which is it's very crazy to think about that. But you know, Richard's become a very dear family friend. And to get a phone call from him and ask him personally to come and do that show with him and to talk out his lyrics with him, it was extraordinary. I don't know how many times people are offered that opportunity to have the writer be their director so that there's no distance between the material and how we're presenting it. And that's what's kind of wonderful about Richard's career is he's made he's had a lifetime's work of being able to wear all different kinds of hats. And it's very much an inspiration, and neither one bleeds into the other in a way that takes away from the production as a whole. If anything, it just bonds it more and allows the actors that much more clear communication to be able to give the performances we have to live up to this really extraordinary material.
So did you know, I'm taking from your statement there, that you knew Richard Maltby Jr. before Starting Here, Starting Now? Or how did you meet?
His daughter, Charlotte Maltby, was in my class at Michigan.
Oh,
and so we had grown up knowing each other simply because he saw me grow as an artist throughout 4 years of college. He became just a dear family friend. He saw me do our senior year. We did a concert in tribute to him. And I was asked to sing If You Want to Die in Bed, which is one of the engineer songs from Miss Saigon. It was very odd. It was very, very odd, but he was very complimentary, but he was also like, that was an interesting choice.
did they bring you in to see you for Chris in Saigon when during the revival?
They did. And that's the same casting director as did Bronx Tale, Mary Sugar. Yeah. They did bring me in, but they put me in a different show instead.
That's wonderful. So I am going to go out on a limb here and say that all of your Christmas shopping is taken care of this year already because of the upcoming release of the Bronx Tale original cast recording. So you are set there.
It came out on my mom's birthday, which is very cool. So
that was great of you. It was perfect that you have that kind of power. You could arrange that. That's good. That's good.
Perfect. I know a guy. I can call somebody.
Excellent. Excellent. So what's it like? Is this your first cast recording?
Yeah, it's my first cast. I mean, it's surreal. It's what I grew up listening to. The first Broadway show I ever saw and the first cast recording I ever listened to in retrospect, too, was Beauty and the Beast, which is an Alan Menken score, and I'm debuting on Broadway in an Alan Menken musical. It's just crazy. and our listening, because we have the great Tommy Mottola producing the album along with Ron Melrose, it very much sounds like a heavily produced pop album as well. I feel like it can be very malleable in the charts that it can be on, more than just a quote unquote Broadway cast album. And because so much of the music that Alan wrote was great pastiche music of the era. So it's doo-wop and Motown and funk. And they just sort of gave the way it was orchestrated and produced in the studio. It just knocks your socks off. So I'm very proud to be on it.
What was the recording process like?
It was about a day and a half, and it was in these great studios. I forget what the name is, but it's on 37th and 10th. And they amped up the orchestration, so they added these gorgeous strings that we don't have in the show to give it some more colors and life. And it was about 15 hours in total of just singing our hearts out. It was quite a test of stamina, but you know, we had an absolute blast doing it.
Are there any funny anecdotes of shenanigans or mistakes or things that went on during the process?
Hopefully there are not too many mistakes. You know, shenanigans are when, you know, because it goes back to the clout and the sort of overwhelming talent that's on this creative team that will, like, I'll do a take, and then you know, Jerry Zaks will walk in and give me a note, and then I'll do it again, and then Bob De Niro will come in and give me a note, and then I'll do it again, and then Tommy Mottola will give me it's like different heroes of yours will walk through the door and just tell you ideas, and it's crazy, and it's wonderful, and it's extraordinary, because you have so many people coming from so many different angles to help you. And as long as you can composite them and filter them towards this one way, which is just the microphone. It's very odd because in the show, I'm narrating to essentially 1,000 people every night. And all of a sudden I had to change that and talk to one person, one listener, one microphone. And that took some tailoring and collaboration to figure out. And I had the best people around me to help me do that.
I was going to say, how did it change for speaking just to a microphone rather than to a full audience? How did that affect your performance for those 15 hours?
Listening to it back, I think the natural timbre of my voice raised a little bit. I think it was amped up that I truly am a 17-year-old versus, I think right now as I'm talking, my voice is just sitting a little lower because it's 10 a.m. But it, you know, that, and that's, I'm a 24-year-old baritone. So it was to put us more in the viewpoint of a 17-year-old living at this time. It's much more, I think, why the show works, even though this story is very gritty and it very much is characters that have their feet on the ground and you wouldn't expect at first glance for them to break out into character, is that it is a sort of fable. It is a sort of, because it is told through the eyes, not only of a 17-year-old, but at first a 9-year-old. And who's written, first of all, who's written more fables music-wise than Alan Menken with every Disney movie in the world? But it sort of gives you a heightened state to bring your way. And so it almost has, I don't want to say like a Disney-like quality, but it has a heightened tempo and energy and awareness of that. We're going to bring you along on this story that is gritty and very real, but also very worthy of it breaking out into song. So it needs to be, I don't know what the word is. It needs to just simply be a little more heightened. It needs to be not magical, but a little ethereal. And I think that's what I heard coming out of the cast recording. I think more than what's done in the show, because I simply have to project more when I'm in the theater to reach 1,000 people. I don't have to project as much when a microphone is right there. So it is more intimate, but it still has to be heightened because we're going to break out in a song in any moment.
So you have this recording experience that you have done. You've got a hit Broadway show that's selling tons of tickets, and you are living the life at 24. And, you know, what do you think is coming up next for you?
You know, I don't know. I mean, I'm in the show at least through November, and if they'll have me for more, we'll sort of play it by ear. But in these really 8 extraordinary creative team members said yes to me. And because of that, that's been able to open a lot of doors, and I'm very fortunate for that. So where the next, you know, you brought up LA very recently in our, very early on in our interview. If that brings me to LA, that's amazing. If that leaves me here in New York doing more theater or doing TV here, who knows? But it's quite extraordinary to have a lot of opportunities coming your way just because these amazing people have given you the platform to really do what you can do. And so we'll see what comes about. But as for now, I'm having an absolute blast, just like you said, narrating the sold out houses every night, telling a great story.
I read that you had created a solo show, Blame It on My Youth. Tell us about that a little bit.
Yeah, that's a solo cabaret. I did first. I'm from San Francisco, so I was given a break at the historic Venetian Room, which reopened about 5-ish years ago. It's where Frank Sinatra debuted I Left My Heart in San Francisco. And Ella Fitzgerald played there, and these really extraordinary artists. And I got to do my solo show there, and then it was picked up by Fine Science at Four Below here in the city. And that'd be, you know, once I have time back on my hands, an absolute wonderful thing to get back out and bring around the country. It's me singing just my absolute favorite music and weaving a story about the rise and fall of a relationship through a series of songs. So there is some banter, but it's very little. It's allowing the lyrics of the songs and the ebbs and flows of how the set has been set up to tell the story of a relationship.
So one last question before I let you go. The University of Michigan has quite a theater mafia here in New York. Have you gotten out to
Absolutely.
See some of your classmates and alumni at other shows? It's very hard to, especially when you're doing 8 times a week, to get out to see your friends in their shows. But, you know, what's it like being part of that mafia?
I mean, it's the greatest Go Blue community you could ever ask for. And it was always discussed and talked about when you were in Ann Arbor as a student, of saying, people have your back in the city, but the second you're here, it's very much true. And you can just look at, it's absurd. You look at every Broadway show and you will find at least one Michigan person. There very much is a tight, the year I graduated, the head of our department, Mr. Brett Wagner, announced his retirement, and we did this elaborate and extraordinary retirement celebration concert at the August Wilson Theater, where all these alumni came back, where Hunter Foster came back and sang Run Freedom Run, where Gavin Creel and Celia Keenan-Bolger and Todd Bonaponte sang Opening Doors as like 3 best friends in college, where Dan Reichard was on the same stage he had done Jersey Boys for years and years. And then all of us that were in the theater stood up and we sang Sunday from Sunday in the Park with George to Brent. You know, I don't know how that could, it warmed all of our hearts and we all realized how very, very fortunate we were. So the shows I have been able to see, I got to see my friends Ashley Park and Jenny Barber in Sunday in the Park with George that Jake Gyllenhaal's in right now, which was just spectacular. I wish I could see Hello Dolly and see Gavin Creel and at Midler, but you know, Jerry Zaks directed that show, so I think I'll have an in to be able to hopefully sneak a ticket in when we have different schedules.
Yeah, and you're coming into the insane season of awards and other things that people are going to be pulling on all of your available time to get involved with. One of the things that will be coming up right after the Tony Awards is, of course, Broadway Bears. So are we going to see you and Nick Cordero doing some Broadway Bears there? You and Nick dancing backstage alone. I know about this. You know.
Oh, geez. How have you heard all these stories? You know, we'll see what happens. I just did Broadway Backwards, actually. It was, a couple weeks ago?
Oh, yeah,
And they dragged me into wearing this, like, gold, like, wrestling singlet that looked like I was auditioning for, like, a gay version of Foxcatcher. So I very much felt like that was my audition for Broadway Bears. So we'll see how it goes. But that was a very, very funny thing. I'm the theater nerd fan of this industry. Like I would have been at home watching all of those videos anyways. So like if they'll have me, it's like amazing. But either way, I'm supporting because I've been supporting it my entire life.
Well, Bobby, thank you so much for chatting with us. Bobby Conti Thornton can be found on Twitter and Instagram at B Conti Thor. We'll have a link to that in the show notes. And of course, you can run over and see him at the Long Acre in A Bronx Tale, the musical, which is ongoing and open ended and selling lots of tickets. So, Bobby, thank you so much for joining us, and we'll speak with you soon.
James, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
This one could be one of the great ones. This one could be one of the ones I won't forget.
Just a quick note for listeners. We recorded this episode a little bit different than most other episodes. Peter's segments were recorded a few days in advance because he had a drama desk meeting on Sunday morning, but wanted to weigh in on some shows and do trivia. And so that's why, in parts of it, Peter will be missing from the conversation. Michael is in Washington, D.C., seeing a handful of shows, and will be back with us next week as well. Okay, Peter, so the other night, you and I and Michael Portantier were at the Broadway Theater on the same night to see the revival of Miss Saigon. So what did you think about it?
I thought it was pretty good. This is a production that came from London. In fact, I saw it in London about a year and a half ago, so I was very impressed at the time, though I did feel it looked a little spare on the stage of the Prince Edward Theater. It doesn't here. Apparently, the Broadway Theater, I mean Broadway is the name of the theater, the Broadway Theater, while it has an enormous number of seats for a Broadway theater, has a smaller stage than the Prince Edward, so it looked a little more chummy here, and that was all to the good. I'm not saying that this was as an elaborate production as we had in 1991 here, but it passes muster, and the helicopter effect, which everybody talks about, is, I think, more spectacular this time around than it was originally, when it seemed to me, if my memory is correct, and it may not be, that the helicopter we just saw from the front and went up and down, well, it's a little more dramatic now. Technology has obviously improved in the last quarter century, and they're able to do much more with it. There's also a very nice film effect that goes with that as well. But, of course, we are talking about the production, and therefore we have to talk about the new people who are in it. John Briones, Eva Nobilzada, and Alastair Brammer. Now, I did see the two leads, John and Eva, in London, and I thought they were terrific there. One of the things that's always bothered me about Miss Saigon is that the middle of the early in the first act, there's suddenly a time shift. And it is true that Kim, the girl who has been abandoned, not by his choice, abandoned during the helicopter out of Saigon, she couldn't get on, he could, that she suddenly was shifting, a number of years have passed. And, well, how do we know that years have passed? Now, she does say that in the lyric, but it's easy to miss. And I always thought this should be a projection saying 3 years later. They don't do that here either. But the one thing about Eva Nobilzada is that she, more than anybody else I've ever seen play the role, and this is my ninth production of Miss Saigon, had the maturity of showing us the 3 years had passed, that she was beaten down by 3 years, that the world had not been good to her in the last 3 years, that she's been lovesick for the last 3 years, that waiting for Chris to return and get her. She did that extraordinarily well. Now, the thing about Eva, though, somehow it is a very personal type of performance in that she seems to be playing to herself. I don't think it's a performance that goes past the footlights. I was sitting fifth row center, dead center, and I was very lucky to have those seats, I'll grant you. But it seemed to me that if I were even a bit more behind, I wouldn't be able to hear her. James, you were a few rows behind me, not many, but a few. Could you hear her?
You know, it's interesting that you bring that up, because that one of the things that I was really concerned about was the sound design for this production. And it wasn't just her, that there was definite sound problems. And I mean, I was 10th row center and I was having a problem hearing everybody. And I know this show pretty well.
So I don't know
if maybe it was just the night that we were there, or if this is an ongoing issue. I'll have to ask people who were at other performances.
Right. Anyway, longtime theater aficionados will know that in 1990 there was a big kerfuffle going on because Jonathan Pryce was coming over from England to do the part, and a lot of people felt that an Asian American or an Asian should be doing the part of the engineer, or at least a Eurasian, which he's really supposed to be. And Cameron McIntosh actually threatened or even said he was going to pull the plug on the production, that he wasn't going to bring it in because he wanted his way. Well, there was such a big advance sale that everybody gave in and the show came over. However, since that time, there has usually been an Asian in the role. And I don't know what ethnic background John Briones comes from, but he does look like the real thing, which is really quite nice. And he does have the personality that that needs to be in this role, the conniver, the sharpie, the person who's been brought up learning that life is hard, that it is a hard knock life over there. And that's one of the things that this production very, very, very successfully achieves. Lawrence Connor's direction really brings up the fact that living in this era and in this part of the world is really, really tough. So it's that really comes through very, very loud and clear here. And John Briones gets our sympathy for having to live through this type of situation. But sympathy only goes so far, because he really will do anything to get ahead. He'll step on anybody. He'll do whatever he has to do. He'll lie. He'll cheat. He'll connive. But we get the feeling we're really seeing the real thing in this production. The real revelation to me was somebody new to me, and that's Alistair Brammer, who played Chris, the best Chris I've ever seen. Has the poignancy for the role. He really seems so nice, and we want Chris to be nice. Now, of course, one of my readers today already wrote in to say, don't you hate musicals that have love at first sight? And it all depends on that. And that's true. I mean, we are dealing with a situation where he sees the girl in the bar, and that night they have sex, and it goes on from there that they're automatically in love. And that is simplistic, and we all know that life's more complicated than that. I wish there had been a number which really revealed – this isn't easy to do, I'll grant you – which revealed the fact that men tend to be with foreign women so that they can dominate them. That's what they like. If he brought her back to this country, you know, he'd know the ropes and she wouldn't know any, and she'd have to be in a very submissive position. And I've seen so many men marry foreign women for that reason. And that's something that happens to men. They get protective. I'm not saying this is venal, but they get protective of these women too. And under those circumstances, they feel like the leader. They feel like they're in charge. And that's something that goes on a lot, especially when a guy is far, far away from home. And we have no idea what Chris's romantic history was. We will find out what it will be, certainly, when he gets married to a woman named Ellen. And she's very understanding under the circumstances when she finds out long after the fact, and he doesn't bring it up to her. Somebody else has to tell her. So Ellen really has a tough time of it with these terrible circumstances, finding out that her husband has this past. And Katie Rose Clark does a very nice job. She's cut in the mold of Liz Callaway, who originated the part, at least here on Broadway. And she finds out from John. John is a soldier who certainly straightens out. He's up for sex and drugs and rock and roll in the first act. But then he realizes how terrible it is that so many of these men impregnated women who have had children. The children are still there, and he wants to do something for those children. And Nicholas Christopher does a lovely job, especially in his second act opener, the very powerful Bui Doi song, where he talks about these children, how terrible it is that the Americans haven't stepped up to the plate and done something for these children. And he's with an organization that's trying to rectify that. So I think it's a very successful evening. I think it's a fine revival. It's going to be very interesting to see how it does, because revivals, Chicago and Cabaret aside, tend not to run as long as the original. And of course, to ask a show to run 10 years as the original Miss Saigon did is a lot to ask. Well, the other thing that works in its favor, of course, is that there hasn't been a movie version that make people say, oh, I've seen that. So I'm going to predict it'll be around for 2 or 3 years. We'll see if that's true, but that would be my educated guess, the 2 or 3 years it'll be around, which gives everybody ample opportunities to get into that very big Broadway theater and see it, which I think is worthwhile doing. But, James, I'm with you. You know, I mean, I picked on Ava, but, yeah, the sound wasn't so good for the other people either, and I hope they work on that, and maybe it was an off night, and but let's hope that they do work on that so all of you can hear as well as see Miss Saigon.
Okay, so Jenna, you and I got a chance to get over to Studio 54 to see the Public Theater's production of Sweat, which played downtown at the Public and has transferred to Studio 54, which the Public has rented to put on this production. So I will start off by saying that I loved Sweat downtown. And I really enjoyed it, looking forward to this production. But when I saw this production the other night at Studio 54, I felt like it lost its edge for me. And it's still a very good production. But I'm not sure if it lost the edge because the theater is so much larger, or if it lost the edge because I had seen it once before and it wasn't new to me. It's still a very good production, and we have, you know, it's more or less the same thing that I had seen downtown. There hasn't been much reworking of it, if any reworking. So, Jenna, did you see it downtown? What did you?
Yes, I did.
You did, and
yes.
What did you think about this production at Studio 54 versus downtown?
I did feel like a little bit of the energy had more room to disperse, which is not always a great thing, but I think it loses a bit of the intimacy in the larger setting. But I think, honestly, Lynn Nottage's work is just strong enough that even in a larger venue, it's still an incredibly powerful experience. And yeah.
It is a very powerful experience for me as well. And I think that the writing is tremendously solid. And I think that we're going to see this show pop up in many regional theaters.
Oh, I hope so. Yes. I think there are a lot of communities that really need to see this play pop up.
So insofar as the performances go, we had some very solid performances downtown and just as strong uptown. Did you have any other insights into the production? Did you notice if they made any changes to it, or...
I didn't notice any changes. If they were there, I didn't catch them. I was listening for certain lines that, knowing how the play ended since I'd seen it downtown, mm-hmm. I was listening for certain lines that foreshadowed where the story was going and what was going to happen. One line that I remember jumping out at me downtown, I was hoping would have been cut and was not, but it has to do with the ending of the play, and I don't want to spoil anything for anyone. But a character announcing why he's going to do something fairly stupid suddenly says, I don't know why I'm doing this. And that almost felt like Lynn Nottage acknowledging that this was it felt almost like Lynn Nottage acknowledging to the audience that this was a dumb move. And the character was aware that this was a bad move, but he was going to do it anyway. And that line jumped out at me. I was hoping that would have been taken out because it did not feel in character for that person to deliver that line. And sadly, it's still there. But, you know, if that's the only weak point in the show, I think we're good. No, I did not notice any differences other than the space is larger between uptown and downtown.
I think that some of the standout performances that we've seen here is Carlo Alban, who plays Oscar, who is doesn't have a lot of lines, but he's a presence on stage.
He is, and yes, agreed.
What were you going to say?
I was going to say, again, the benefit of having seen it downtown and now seeing it uptown, knowing where his story arc would go, keeping an eye on him now, I was more aware of how present he is in every moment. And it is so worthwhile to watch him watching the other actors who have the showier roles. He is such a quiet presence, but it is a dramatic presence. He is always watching and he is absorbing all of this as it's happening around him. And it's a real study in minimalism, but he does it beautifully.
I really hope that he gets recognized during the upcoming award season, because the work that he's doing there, I think you hit upon it exactly, is that having seen it before and seeing and knowing to watch him during the show now, it's just a lesson in acting there. He's just really wonderful. And I'm very excited that he is, he's got this showcase here, and hopefully we'll see him in other stuff as well.
Absolutely. Yes. And there are the showier roles as well. Joanna Day and Michelle Wilson do excellent work as these women on the factory line. And they have the showier, bigger roles, and they do beautiful work with it. But compared to Mr. Alban, it's just fascinating to see the different performances in this one play and how you can have very big and bold strokes, but they're just as important are the smaller, quieter strokes as well. They all make up this amazing painting.
Yeah, so this is playing over at Studio 54. I'm not sure. Is it an open run? Do you know, or is
it
a limited
it is,
run?
I am looking on the in the program, and I believe it's an open run.
No, it's an open run.
Perfect.
And this seems like the sort of play that it can draw in a Broadway audience and hopefully keep going.
And definitely. And speaking of the audience, I was really pleased to notice as we were going in and picking up our tickets that it was a very diverse crowd. And I really hope this reaches out to a wider audience beyond the traditional people who usually come to Broadway shows. It's a play about blue collar workers. I hope it brings in blue collar workers who want to see themselves reflected on stage. And I was very pleased to see that it was not just the typical people who we expect to see at most Broadway musicals or Broadway musicals, Broadway plays. Wow, kind of interesting that my instinctive word after Broadway is musical. But in any case, I'll take that up with my therapist. But I hope, as we were saying earlier, I hope this play has a long life in regional theaters as well and reaches out to a very wide audience. This is a great play to generate discussion and conversation. It takes place during the 2000 election. And as we see, you know, we know where things are going to go. It takes place between 2000 and then jumps ahead to 2008, just before the 2008 election. And we know what's going to happen. We know where the economy is going to go and where all these blue collar jobs are going to go. We can assign blame for how the economy turned around and what happened over the Bush administration and the Obama administration and all the ups and downs that the country has faced in terms of jobs and communities. But this play is a great way to generate a conversation, get a wide range of people in to see it, and then talk about it. I would love to attend some post-show discussions and see what people say, what they take away from it, and what different kinds of audiences take away from it. Do they see this as a play about latent racism? Do they see it as a play about classism? Or is it about How Ambition Destroys Friendships? Is it a play about the need for strong unions? There are so many different elements that are worth debating. And I really hope this play keeps those conversations going and gets people discussing and maybe changing the way they think about things, the way they've thought about certain issues. I will have to say this play changed the way I thought about some certain issues. So it definitely works as a conversation starter and as a think piece.
So, Peter, you got down to the Barrow Street Theater where we have a new production of Sweeney Todd that has come to us also from London. So how has the pie shop changed?
Yes, the Barrow Street Theater is unrecognizable. It's now been turned into Harrington's Pie Shop. And the reason it's called Harrington's is because in London, there is a pie shop called Harrington's, and somebody had the nice idea of doing Sweeney Todd in this actual pie shop in Harrington's. This place has been around since 1910, so it's a very venerable establishment, and all Londoners know about it. And so going there not only to have one of their meat pies or vegetable pies, but also to see Stephen Sondheim's masterpiece seemed like a good idea. And it is a good idea. Well, here we don't have a Harrington, so they had to totally reconfigure the Barrow Street Theater. And the orchestra is filled with benches. Think of the opening scene of Oliver, where the orphanage kids are at benches. They're like that. And you sit at long, long tables. And frankly, I would advise many people who are shy about being part of the action, I don't quite mean audience participation, but part of the action, to sit in the mezzanine/balcony. I think you're also going to see the show better that way, because you're going to have, if you're in the orchestra, you're going to have 1,000 cranes of the neck trying to see this, that, and the other thing, because a lot of the action takes place at adjoining tables, and characters actually jump on the tables. You hear the expression "in your face." There's never been a show that's been as in your face as this Sweeney Todd, because believe me, these actors, especially Sweeney, will glare at you and growl at you. And if you're bald, do prepare to have Tobias, when he's purveying Pirelli's miracle elixir, to rub it on your head, you know. And all I can say is, let's hope that Sweeney's implication that it really is piss is wrong, you know, because I'd hate to have that on anybody's bald head. So if you're shy of that type of thing, buy a balcony seat. But whatever the case may be, this is certainly a Sweeney worth seeing. Now, there are only 3 musicians on hand, but it doesn't really seem to matter, because the voices are so strong. And not only are the voices strong, they're strong without amplification. So it's nice to hear the Sondheim score without any amplification whatsoever. So that's an asset as well. Okay, how are the characters portrayed? Wonderfully, by Jeremy Seacombe, who plays Sweeney, and Siobhan McCarthy, who plays Mrs. Lovett. And they're both crazy as loons, no question about that. And but what's really wonderful about Seacombe Sweeney is that he really goes from anger to madness very, very well. The trajectory is terrific. But one thing I haven't quite seen on any other Sweeney, and granted, this is the closest I've ever been to a Sweeney, but I've never seen in any other Sweeney, after he kills the judge, that he has nothing to live for. His face really indicated, I why am I living? There's no point in it now. And Mrs. Lovett, in the wonderful song Wait, talks about half the fun is to plan the plan. And it does seem that that was something that really drove him, and now it's all over. And I've never seen that on anybody's face, but Jeremy Seacombe did that very well. Mrs. Lovett really has a very nice voice for this role, and she can make it beautiful when she talks about which there's a word beautiful in one of the songs, and she makes it quite beautiful. So she's very, very effective as well. Tobias, excellent, very nice performance, very youthful, very vigorous. Pirelli, by the way, is played by Betsy Morgan, who also plays the beggar woman. There's only 8 people in the cast, and that includes our beloved Brad Oscar, who people may know from The Producers or his wonderful stint during the entire run of Something Rotten playing Thomas Nostradamus. So he's on hand to play Beetle Bamford, and he's quite good as well. Those who saw the film may grouse about the fact, I've heard this a lot, you know, oh my God, it was so bloody. Oh, I can't stand it. And I will admit that it certainly was very bloody. That doesn't happen here. In the manner of Greek tragedy, all the violence takes place off stage. Now, understand this is a very minimalist production, very minimalist. Don't expect that snazzy barber chair that swoops down and goes into the takes the bodies down into the basement. No, the barber's chair is a stool, and that will have to do. So it's very bare bones, but it doesn't matter at all because the show is so wonderful. We always talk about it being Stephen Sondheim's Sweeney Todd, but, you know, it's Hugh Wheeler's Sweeney Todd, too. And what I love about it is that in the second act, Toby comes on to talk to Mrs. Lovett because he's suspicious that something's going on. He just has a bad feeling about it. Something's bothering him. Something doesn't seem right. Now, believe me, a lesser writer would have had Toby walk in on Mrs. Lovett and Sweeney Todd shoving bodies into the burner, you know, and Hugh Wheeler knows that that's a clumsy thing to do. So as a result, he brings him in being suspicious. And then what happens, which is so wonderful, is Mrs. Lovett takes out her purse, and it's the purse she stole from Pirelli, whom Sweeney murdered earlier. And because Toby used to work for Pirelli, well, he recognizes the purse. And that's really wonderful because, to use an expression that really doesn't fit, Mrs. Lovett is hoisted on her own petard because she's the one who implicated herself by taking out the purse. So that's much more effective than having Toby walk in at the wrong time. Think about when you watch shows where and movies or TV shows where, indeed, people walk in at the wrong time. There are millions of them, and as for me, I roll my eyes when it happens, so there's no eye rolling here. What's also wonderful, too, about Hugh Wheeler's writing and the direction, the original direction by Harold Prince, and certainly direction here by Bill Brockhurst, is that Mrs. Lovett is an expert liar. Now, in so many inferior works, people lie unconvincingly. Somebody asks a question, they go, you see, what really happened was, and if that happened in real life, you would either say, you're lying, or at least you'd know it, you know. But Mrs. Lovett is good. She never pauses when she has to lie. She's really terrific at that. And again, that's a very smart way to characterize the woman, because she's not a nice lady, is she? So now, for $22.50 extra, which I don't think is worth the money, I will tell you that right now, you can also go an hour and 15 minutes earlier and eat a meat pie or a vegetable pie with mash, which is what the English term for mashed potatoes, and liquor. Now, hold on. Liquor doesn't mean liquor as we know it. Liquor is the term used in London for parsley sauce, which it's this green stuff that they put as a garnish on the plate. However, to be fair, they do give you liquor. You can have beer or wine or a soft drink in a can. They'll give you that as well, depending on what you want. And that's $22.50. I don't think it's worth the money. I don't, because there's meat pie is about as big as an iPhone. And so I'd say save your money, eat elsewhere. But do see this Sweeney Todd. It will be something you'll remember for a long time to come, no matter how many Sweeneys you've seen.
And it seems to be a very hot ticket, hard to get right now. I wonder how long they will keep extending it out if it keeps selling. I mean, it's at the Barrow Street Theater. I don't know if something else is scheduled to come in there. So,
well, I don't know about that either. But, of course, there will be a change come April 11th, which is fast approaching. These people from London are not doing it for long. Soon Norm Lewis will be playing Sweeney, and Carolee Carmello will be playing Mrs. Lovett. That starts April 11th. So if you want to see the original revival cast, by all means, go there now. And it's not going to be easy to get in because there are only about, I think, 90 seats. So so you may have to see Norm Lewis and Carolee Carmello, which is not a fate worse than death. I'm making it sound, you know, but still, this Sweeney by Jeremy Seacombe is quite menacing. There's a wonderful moment, too, when Mrs. Lovett is singing by the sea and she essentially proposes. And the look that he gives when he realized that she's saying, let's get married, in so many words, is really quite priceless. So so I my fond regards and best wishes to Norm Lewis and Carolee Carmello. But they do have very hard acts to follow.
So, Jenna, this
yes.
week you saw Joan of Arc down at the Public. Peter saw
yes.
it last week and reported on it. So why don't you tell us, what did you think of Joan of Arc?
Well, I agree and disagree with Peter's comments from last week. Peter talked about anachronistic music and how this bothers him. And I offer a counter argument to that, that theater is an illusion. We accept this as we're sitting in the audience looking up at the stage. It is all an illusion, and we are not really in 15th century France. We are in New York, down at the Public Theater, and this is 90 minutes where we can suspend our disbelief and enjoy an illusion, the illusion of theatricality. You know, if we can accept rap and hip hop in Hamilton, if we can accept 1960 style pop in Jesus Christ Superstar, we could accept rock music in Into the Fire. I did not find the use of rock music to be a major distraction. I did not find it to be jarring. That said, I do agree with Peter that the music is fine, if not very memorable, but he said it suffers from lyrical laziness, and I love that phrase. Thank you, Peter, for that. I think it's the slant rhymes, they're generally acceptable in rock music, but they really jump out in theater when they're used. It's to me, it's a weakness. A lot of the songs sound very similar, and none of them really jumped out at me. The banal lyrics just really kept the characters very two-dimensional, and I think that's the play's biggest weakness. The characters are very two-dimensional, and they're given no room to become complex, fully realized characters. They're not that compelling. David Byrne did a really lovely job with Here Lies Love, which was also staged at the Public several years ago. That production turned a theater into a disco space, and we're in the middle of this, you know, the wild 70s and 80s party scene, and it's great because we're all caught up in it. We're walking around. We're experiencing this with the Marcoses in the Philippines in the 70s and 80s. That's great, but there's no concept here to convey the mood or convey the vibe of the story. And the show just doesn't seem to know what it wants to be. Is this a story about a patriot? Is it about gender nonconformity? There's repeated lines throughout the show. I'm not a boy, but I'm not a girl. Is it about the patriarchy and about how men will use and discard women to their own ends? Or is this about a religious fanatic, another critic who was sitting near me during the show as we walked out, compared Joan's passion and her violence and her religious fervor to an ISIS recruiting video. And that really that stuck in my mind that, yeah, there's something to be said for someone advocating war through the use of religion and insisting God has told me to go kill people. And that really jumped out. That's an angle that doesn't really get explored as much. It's more focused on her love of God and her religious devotion, and then now she's going off to battle. It's only 90 minutes. It drags, honestly. 90 minutes felt much longer, and it needs to figure out what it wants to be, and it could go places, but it needs work. It needs to be focused better. The lyrics need to be cleaned up so that they there are not so many slant rhymes, but also I want to see if it's going to be sung through, then I want the songs to really convey more of the character other than Joan wants to go to war and she loves God, and all of these men who get a few little moments here and there have a bit more to do, and we see their complexity and we see them more realized as three-dimensional characters. Joe Lampert plays Joan. She is fierce, just wonderful, and I would love to see what she can do with stronger material. Christopher Barecca's set is terrific. He uses a lot of stairs and platforms and crosses made of LED lights that can become rain or all kinds of other images. Very nice work with that. Clint Ramos did the costumes. They convey all the different positions in the social structure and the military structure for the cast. Very, very nice job. Alex Timbers did the direction, and the direction is fine, but Timbers did a much better work with Here Lies Love and even Bloody Bloody Andrew Jackson, other rock musicals at the Public. Timbers' work I thought was much better on those than with Joan of Arc. Joan of Arc has promise and potential, but that's really the best thing I can say about it. If with some work, it could go further. It could be a compelling musical. But right now, it's just not.
Last week, Michael talked about Engine Rep down at the gym at Judson, where the transport group is doing it. Peter, you got a chance to see Picnic, which is one of the two shows here. So tell us, what do you think about Picnic?
Well, you know, Picnic is a problematic play for me because what happens at the end doesn't seem to me to be the right decision. But let's start at the very beginning. And this is a story that takes place in the Midwest. A picnic is going to happen, but before it does, we are going to meet some people who are going to really take our fancy. One is Flo, wonderfully played by Michelle Park, who has two daughters. One of them is Madge, who's the most beautiful girl in town. And as a result, she has many admirers. Now, the mother, Flo, has not had a good marriage. The husband isn't there anymore. And she knows, as she tells her daughter forthright, girls don't have that much time when they're beautiful and desirable. In a few years, this is all going to go away, so you must strike while the iron is hot. And as a result, she is encouraging a romance with Alan, who's the richest kid in town, who does take to Madge, probably because she's so wonderfully pretty. So even though Flo knows that this is not a marriage made in heaven, but more in the First National Bank, she still wants it to happen because she wants her daughter to have the life that she didn't have. She wants her to have economic security. Well, that may be one reason why Madge doesn't take to Alan, because indeed her mother wants her to, and you know, rebellious kids. So that turns out to be a problem. Also, Alan doesn't have like this phenomenal personality, and he does seem callow and naive and not somebody you'd really want to spend your life with. So we're on Madge's side there. But who comes to town but Hal? Hal's a guy who just has not had any luck, and also he's made bad luck for himself because he's also spent some time in prison, and that comes out before the show is over. And but he's good-looking, and he's got a great body, and suddenly Madge is very attracted to him. And Flo is just going crazy because she doesn't want her to marry this drifter. And that's all he is. He doesn't have a job. He does odd jobs here and there. He's working right now for the woman across the street who hires young things to work for her. She doesn't have any designs on them, really. What she just likes is, she says, to have a man around the house. It makes her feel better. And so what we have here is a situation, the love triangle that always happens. And I'm going to give away the ending because I want to make a point here. It's always bothered me that Madge decides to go with Hal, because after all, how long is it going to be? As her mother says, you know, how long is it going to be before you wind up hating him, because he's not going to have a job, he's not going to give you anything, and life is going to be dreary. And you have to be on the mother's side there. But what's really terrific is that Inge knows this too, and he says, he has the next door neighbor, Mrs. Potts, say to her, "But could have anybody stopped you when you were that age?" In other words, mistakes go from one generation to the next. And Michelle Park really has a wonderful expression on her face when she's told this. She knows that nobody could have talked her out of her marriage when it happened. It just can't be done. Youth just believes everything is going to work out splendidly. The famous expression, "we'll manage," is very easy to say, but it's harder to achieve. So that's what redeems the play, because otherwise it would just be a sad story about a woman who makes the wrong decision. I'm not saying Alan is the right decision, but I know Hal is the wrong decision. It's more wrong here because David T. Patterson, who plays it, certainly has the looks, certainly has the body for it. But I do think that the director, who's Jack Cummings III, who always does the transport group shows and usually does a wonderful idea, has made him a little too whiny. And he needs not to be so whiny. He needs not to cry as much, all that kind of business, no matter how much is to spare. The old adage in the theater is, if the performer cries, the audience will not. If the performer doesn't cry when he should cry, or we'd expect him to cry, then we cry for him, and that's much better. That doesn't happen in this production, so that's a problem. However, I do have to say Heather McRae as Mrs. Potts is really spectacularly wonderful and warm and brings everything that could possibly be brought to this part, and I think she's well worth seeing. Jenna Levine, or Levine, no idea, because it's L-E space V-I-N-E, is fine as Madge. It's a terrible thing to say, but I can't see that she's the most beautiful girl in town. Now, also, because times are tough in this household, they've taken in a boarder, and that's Rosemary, who is the woman who teaches in the local high school. And within 4 seconds of your meeting her, she brings up the fact that she's an old maid. She wants to say it before you can. She wants you to know that she knows it and she's at peace with it, except she really isn't. Now, this scene her scenes didn't work for me nearly as well as they do in the wonderful movie where Rosalind Russell played this part. Here it's Emily Skinner, and in many instances she's fine. But the wonderful thing about Rosalind Russell in the movie is she's dating this man, Howard, who was played by Arthur Kennedy in the movie. And here, Howard is played by John Cariani very well. Again, Something Rotten People is still working because he was the playwright in Something Rotten. So there we are, and we see Rosemary and Howard. And the thing about Rosalind Russell is she really made it seem as if she was doing Howard a favor, that she was dating him, that she doesn't think much of him. Whenever she talks to her friends about him, she's very condescending about him, type of thing, like, oh, you know Howard. Yes, I'm going out with Howard. Yeah. I mean, he's better than nothing. And then what happens is a phenomenal scene where she literally, I mean literally, begs him to marry her. And by begging, I mean on her knees begging. And you really see how desperate she is to have a man. And Emily Skinner doesn't prepare us for that scene nearly as well, because she doesn't have that condescending, Howard, he's nothing, type of feeling. She has a little of it, but not a lot of it, not nearly as much as Rosalind Russell. And that's a big problem for this production, because you really want to be so moved and really see the real Rosemary when the time comes when she's on her knees begging this man to marry her. So and I have to say, too, that the movie does it better in the way that it happens. It believe me, Howard doesn't say, okay, then yes, I feel bad for you, I'll marry you. It's not that simple. And things happen in an accidental way in the movie that really seem like the poor guy is just trapped into this, and he just can't say no. But here it doesn't seem to be that way. Now, I will admit that it's very possible that the screenwriter of the movie, and frankly, I don't know if it was Inge or not, decided to do it differently. Or even if Inge did it, he decided to do it differently after seeing the play, which ran over a year in New York in its original production. So it's a mixed bag here. And but for Michelle Park, for Heather McRae, I do think it's worth seeing this picnic.
Okay, so before we go on to trivia, I want to remind everybody that you can subscribe to these broadcasts by going to the front page of Broadway Radio, and there's a subscribe link. That way, each and every time we have a new episode of This Week on Broadway, it'll be automatically downloaded to iTunes for you. Of course, you don't have to listen to us in iTunes. There are many ways you can listen to us. One of them is iHeartRadio, who picks up all of our shows on the Broadway Radio Network and plays them 24/7. Google, you can get us at the Google Play store. You can play us at iTunes. You can play us on Stitcher. You can find us on TuneIn and many other places that you can listen to finer podcasts. Broadway World Radio plays us Wednesdays at noon, Thursdays at 7 p.m., and Saturdays at 2 p.m. Contact information for Peter, for Jenna, for me can be found at BroadwayRadio.com, as well as links to some of the things we've talked about today, including Bobby Conte Thornton's links to his shows and Instagram and Twitter and various things like that we've talked about. Okay, Peter, so do you have an answer to last week's trivia?
Yeah, I asked what 1960s Tony-nominated musical, the first but hardly the last Tony-nominated musical that this composer lyricist would have, had a lyric that referenced two Rodgers and Hammerstein songs in one line. Seriously, out of 8 words, 5 were originally Hammerstein. was the song, the show, and the composer's lyricist's name? Well, Pat Payne was the first to get it, followed by Jake Leonard. And the answer is, the show is Milk and Honey. The song is Chin Up Ladies, in which Molly Picon sings, "Climb every mountain to find your Mr. Snow." So, of course, Climb Every Mountain comes from The Sound of Music, and Mr. Snow comes from Carousel. So that's the answer to that question. This question for this week. Okay, remember in math when you used to have those analogies where 3 is to 6 as 4 is to 8, that type of thing? You had to figure out what 3 is to 6 as 4 is to what, and you had to figure out it's 8 because 3 times 2 is 6 and 4 times 2 is 8. Okay. Stephen Sondheim is to Sideshow as George Gershwin is to what? That's our trivia question for this week.
You know, I was never good at them on the SATs either. All right. If you're better at the SATs than I was, and you have an idea about what Peter's talking about, email us at trivia@broadwayradio.com. We'll let you know if you are on the right track. All right. So on behalf of Jenna Tessa Fox and Peter Felicia, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
I got you.